Be seated. Let us pray. Now to the one who is able to do abundantly, exceedingly, beyond all that we ask or think, according to the power at work in us, to him be all glory in the church by Jesus Christ through all generations, forever and ever. Amen. On one hand, the spiritual life would seem pretty straightforward and simple. Do your best. Love God. Love others. Try to do the right thing. Don't be too selfish. It all seems pretty obvious. But on the other hand, when you try to figure out what faithfulness looks like in the minute by minute, day by day unfolding of your life, it soon becomes apparent that all of this gets very complicated. Does my consumption of fast food hurt the earth and contribute to the suffering of animals raised on factory farms subject to systematic abuse, in addition to not being very good to our appearances? Does my addiction to my cell phone further the plight of the poorly paid millions, mostly children and teenagers toiling countless hours, 7 days a week in sweatshops, or harvesting the exploited resources of their impoverished countries? Should I show concern to the Hispanic population, those who spend hot hours in migrant farms to help put food on my table and supply the shelves of the grocery stores I frequent? Those who staff the restaurants I like, to clean the hotels I stay in, the offices where I hold meetings? Should I be concerned about their legitimate need as they are concerned about family members and their own friends? How can I combat a culture of wealth and privilege when I am so much a part of this culture of wealth and privilege that so consistently and masterfully turns a blind eye to those deemed marginalized and forgotten? What's it really like? What's it really like to live in desperate need of food or shelter or clothing or health care? If I truly love God as I say I do, what is my role to aid in the literal billions of elderly men and women and children living here today on this planet with me in vulnerable, war-torn, and conflicted communities and situations? I thought you said religion was pretty straightforward and simple. But as we wrestle with the questions of today's challenges, it gets pretty complicated, pretty fast. And the questions, they just come tumbling out on and on and on with the recognition that loving God cannot be just a mere sentiment without some kind of sensible action. But it's impossible to be a decent disciple without wrestling with the hard questions in some very deep, troubling ways. Love of God in the context of sharing that love of God with those God also loves requires translation into meaningful steps of engagement. So we really shouldn't be too surprised or upset with Jesus when he starts telling all these stories and parables. Parables that oftentimes are hard to understand. Now, as we've journeyed with Jesus through the Gospel of Matthew, we've learned that it's not been a rosy, easy journey. That those who are in power have been threatened by this revolutionary upstart. They recognize that some of the things that he's talking about, the way he's embracing the marginalized, that he's healing those who have hurts, he's taking care of those who live on the periphery, would upset the balance of power, a balance of power that they are firmly in control of. That they are sitting at the top of the pyramid and they don't want to see that pyramid flip upside down. Were the parables a way for Jesus to get his religious message across without being too plain or too obvious? Well, even as we make this journey, we recognize that it's just not the powerful who seems to misunderstand Jesus. Even the disciples are left scratching their heads most times. And by the end of chapter 12, it's not just Jesus' home community that questions who he is and what he's come to do. It's even members of his own family. Let that sink in for a little bit. I mean, my mom's right here. She's a member of the congregation. I have no wiggle room whatsoever. Go ahead and wiggle. Now, she gives me plenty of freedom. I should not pick on my delightful mother because she's not a good target. Right? I mean, what's it like to have a family member come to you and say, buddy, you're off track? I miss the blessed mother, Mary, Jesus, you're off track. Let me tell you a parable. Man, it's amazing, right? So is Jesus trying to hint at this kingdom? Is he trying to give some kind of coded message to the inside circle? No. What's he up to? Why is he shaking us up like this? I wonder if in part what Jesus is doing is trying to suggest that the religious journey is a lot more textured and complicated than the simplicity with which we oftentimes want to make it. That the journey will be difficult. That sometimes the road will not be clear. That oftentimes we'll be scaling high cliffs and in deep valleys. That the terrain of our spiritual journey may leave us scratching our heads before it's patting each other on the back. The crowds were coming. If you were a Baptist, you would say, pass the offering plate before you say, pass the fried chicken. Look how successful we're being. Look how many people are listening. Look how they're kind of just falling out of the highways and byways. And then Jesus tells them a parable. He gets on a boat. He gets away from the crowd. And he leaves them wondering, are you really the one that we've been looking for and hoping for, and we can find hope in our lives? Or should we look for another? Bishop Will Williman, a Methodist, says it this way: Jesus explained God with unexplained stories, most of which lack neat endings or immediately apparent points. It's as if Jesus says that God is met amid the stuff of daily life and the tug and pull of the ordinary, yet God is rarely self-evident, obvious, or with uncontested meaning. In parables, says Williman, the joke's on us. And maybe that's a little too harsh, maybe. But authentic spiritual transformation is not like looking for the answers in the back of the textbook. It results from a serious and intentional and likely lifelong effort to learn, to grow, to remain faithful, even when all the answers are not so easy or apparent or more challenging with the more years we live. Catholic mystic Richard Rohr says it this way: most people do not see things as they are because they see things as they are. Most people do not see things as they are because they see things as they are. Which means we really don't see anything authentically at all without some level of sensitive dialogue with someone else's experience. Are you familiar with the line of thinking that all those screens that we look at nonstop, television screens, computer screens, iPhones, cell phones, iPads, that they are not windows into the world, but they are merely mirrors that reflect our own self? Especially if you're on something like Facebook. Have you ever noticed you'll be shopping at another site looking for an item, and then you go back to Facebook and there's that item popping up? Oh, did you forget about those pair of shoes? Why? Because all of these pieces of information that are pushed to you are based on complicated algorithms and formulas, charting what you look at, what you click, what you like, what you approve of, providing a profile for you so that the messages that you're being sent are the ones that you've already pre-chosen. I call it electronic Calvinism. That you've already determined those things that you will like, and therefore you are constantly fed the very same things of which you are committed to, and that just reinforces your understanding that the world looks exactly like the way I feel, and therefore the world validates who I am. It's not an insight into the world, it's a preoccupation with perhaps a narcissistic personality. The part of the reason we have divisions in our society is because people are only going to the watering well that agrees with them and never really being in serious conversation with someone that might differ with them. And if all your relationships are electronic, then that's a virtual hellscape of community. Not real community that satisfies deeply in the calling for us to love God and love others the way that we are invited to live. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. You see, there's a wide gulf between you, 21st century city dweller, and that pioneer of 250 years ago that came to an area like the backyard of Fayette Mall and had to spend every waking moment clearing rocks and trees and weeds and debris and overgrowth in order to make a fertile field appropriate for seed. In other words, you shouldn't expect too much progress unless you're willing to get some dirt under your fingernails, some calluses on your palms, some strength and fiber in your being. So I appreciate those who are willing to think about these parables a little more creatively, resisting perhaps the typical and too often boring traditional interpretation. For how many times, even within the own passage that we've read, has the story of the soils been talked about as four classifications of people? Person A, the early adopter who suffers from ADD, They hear a great idea and decide, that's the best idea I've ever heard. I'm going to make a change in my life. And at the spur of the moment, they are ready to sign on the dotted line. Until 24 hours have elapsed and their promise is soon forgotten and they're on to the next thing. Or person B, the worry wart, so concerned about the exterior world of demands and pressures that they spend absolutely no time focused on the interior life of the soul. They're the type who would never miss the morning news feed, but who rarely find the time to take the worries of the world into the sanctuary of their poorly constructed prayer life. Or person C, the sold-out materialist. They can't pass up a good bargain or a sweet deal, especially one dripping in profit. Whatever can be expedited is encouraged. It's a world of the fast cash and the greasy palms with a constant eye for what is in it for me. And then there's person D. Don't we all want to be person D? The last shall be first. Those we say, get it, do well, concerned with the general welfare, take their time, are patient, are reflective and considerate. They see the presence of God in the ordinary things and they don't let frustrations grow into life-robbing problems. And while it might be convenient that we could judge and categorize and place people in these four different categories on where they are, it might be more helpful, certainly more redemptive, to consider the different types of soils, not to relate to different types of people, but to relate to various typologies of responses within our own hearts. What if we could do a soil sample in the terrain of our souls? Where is there a beaten path, so well beaten that you've even put a layer of asphalt on top of it where you're resistant to any new idea or any new insight or any fresh truth? Where in our garden of life have we let things to get a little out of control and unmanaged, overgrown and overwhelmed with worry and weeds? Where do we need to do some pruning, some plucking, some uprooting? Where do we need to remove the heavy boulders before we can set the tiller and turn over the dry, impacted earth? What Barbara Brown Taylor and others want us to see is not just the vital importance of cultivating fertile soil, but also the liberality with which the sower goes about sowing seed. Casting seed, have you noticed? On all four types of soil. The extravagance of a God who does not reserve the best only for the best, who offers blessings upon all, casting light and life and energy down cliffs and canyons and fields of wheat and waste, trusting that in the darkness, inhabited only by worms and insects, is the place of fertilization and fertility. You see, God throws seeds. God doesn't throw in the towel. Our questions may be too big for us, but they're not too complicated for God. We may have given up and thought it's purposeless, but the sower is unrelenting in offering new ideas, new seeds, new possibilities, new avenues of life. The path, it's not always easy. It could be hard. There's not ready-made solutions. But the seeds are abundant, waiting for us to make good soil in a relationship of New Harvest. So, the spiritual life, it's not easy. Sometimes easier than others, but most times it's pretty hard. And that's okay. That's as it should be. Let those who have ears listen and keep listening.